I think you could probably rightly say that we all are concerned about what the mayor decided to do.
The University of Alaska reacts to the mayor's decision on the UMed Road. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 7th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an effort to tear down an obsolete dam on the Eklutna River.
There are five species of salmon that spawn in the lower reaches of the Eklutna, but they can't get past the dam.
Those stories tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
When Shell announced it was giving up on its exploration project in the Arctic Ocean, it blamed in part the challenging regulatory climate. But an inspector general's report released today says many of the government regulators who worked the case felt they were too rushed to provide a rigorous review. The IG report looks at the final environmental analysis of Lease Sale 193. It was the second court-mandated do-over conducted years after Shell and other companies already won their leases. Several scientists and supervisors working for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in Alaska told investigators they were under such tight timelines leading up to Shell's 2015 drilling season, they were unable to do a good job. At least three BOEM employees resigned or retired early over their dissatisfaction. The inspector general, though, rejected allegations that non-scientist managers at BOEM had manipulated the scientific findings. The investigators also noted that an outside agency reviewed the science in the environmental study and found it adequate. Michael Levine is an attorney for Oceana, one of the environmental groups that challenged the original environmental impact statement for the lease sale. Levine says the investigation shows the final report was rushed and compromised.
The fact that the inspector general found no legal wrongdoing, it does not mean that a better, more complete process might not have led to a better, more complete decision.
The investigation found that Interior Chief of Staff Tommy Boudreau set an aggressive timeline for the final environmental study. Boudreau said he wanted it done in time for the 2015 drilling season so that Shell couldn't blame the department if the company decided not to proceed. Boudreau also told investigators he knew Senator Lisa Murkowski would be critical if they didn't get the study done on time. The senator's spokesman, Robert Dillon, says Murkowski wanted to ensure the regulators gave Shell a fair chance to develop its leases.
If they needed more manpower or more hours, they could have allotted more resources to the job. They could do that. They can't blame the senator because the senator is trying to make sure that they're doing their job.
In response to the investigation, a deputy interior secretary said BOEM staff worked long hours to meet their deadlines and that despite overtime pay, employee morale suffered. The Alaska Supreme Court has settled a boundary dispute between Juneau and Petersburg affecting about 1,500 square miles of southeast Alaska. Under the decision the court issued on Friday, Petersburg borough boundaries will stand as they are now that Juneau has lost its last legal challenge on the matter. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
Petersburg Mayor Mark Jensen says his borough was ready for the decision.
Well, I think it's good news, you know, definitely for Petersburg. You know, we've already been moving ahead like that was in our borough, so I'm glad to hear that it is.
The previously contested land is almost completely uninhabited national forest. An old estimate puts the population at one. Still, local control and some revenue were at stake. Petersburg Borough Manager Stephen Giesbrecht says the annexed land boosts state revenue sharing and some federal payments.
You know, if the borough formation would not have happened, our financial situation here in the borough would have been a lot different than it is today. I mean, we're like everybody else. We're having to look for things to cut, but because of the borough formation, we are not having to do it in ways that other communities have done.
Petersburg fishermen are responsible for more than 90% of the commercial haul from the area. Juneau businesses and residents own most of the private land. Goldbelt Incorporated, Juneau's urban native corporation, owns about 30,000 acres in the annexed area around Hobart Bay. Since logging ended there in 1999, Goldbelt has explored turning it into a cruise ship destination and planted 80,000 gooey duck seed for an experimental aquaculture operation. Goldbelt anticipates Hobart Bay gooey duck will be harvest ready beginning around 2023, according to its last annual report. Attorney Amy Mead argued the case for Juneau before the Supreme Court in June. She says it was a worthwhile fight.
I don't necessarily consider it a loss. We thought the law stood for something that needed clarification, and the court is now clarified. I think it really solidifies that it's the commission's decision how to frame the question in making a boundary determination.
Since Mead is the City and Borough of Juneau's staff attorney, fighting the case carried only incidental expenses. In Juneau, with help from Ed Schoenfeld, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has withdrawn the city's support for the $20 million Northern Access Project, also called the UMED District Road. The Department of Transportation says without the municipality's backing, work on the controversial project that links Elmore and Brigaw will stop. Berkowitz stated his position in a letter to the State Commissioner of Transportation on Friday.
We made the decision because in this time of fiscal austerity at the state level, there needs to be a distinction between wants and needs.
Berkowitz is asking the state's legislature to reappropriate the leftover $17 million to the Port of Anchorage. Jaron Tarr, who represents some of the communities that would have been impacted by the road, says the legislature will have to vote to move the money to a different project. Otherwise, the appropriation will stay in place until 2019, then will revert to the general fund. Tarr says she supports the mayor's decision because he is responding to the community's concerns about the negative environmental and quality of life impacts.
I hope this process encourages people that it can work out, that, you know, your voice can be heard. And I know that sometimes people just don't feel that. So, you know, I hope that part of this isn't lost on people, that citizen activism can have an impact on the outcome.
Bill Spindle is Vice Chancellor of Administrative Services at the University of Alaska Anchorage, which has been a longtime supporter of the project.
We've talked to all the other main organizations in the UMED district. They're all also disappointed. So I think you could probably rightly say that we all are concerned about what the mayor decided to do.
Providence Hospital supported the road to help emergency vehicles access the area. In a written statement, the hospital said they continue to support improved access to the district and will consider additional steps. In an effort in Bethel to entice workers to stay with better housing options.
We're really just trying to provide an environment where they can call home. At the end of the day, they got a place to kick their feet up. They feel welcome.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Tesoro's pending acquisition of Flint Hills Fuel distribution and marketing operations in Fairbanks, North Pole, and Anchorage will streamline the transportation of refined petroleum products from South Central to the interior. Tesoro Vice President of Strategy and Business Development Nate Weeks told the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation's Energy Task Force on Friday that access to the railroad out of Anchorage is key.
We currently serve customers with trucks in the interior, and you know that's a long haul in good weather.
Weeks does not expect the change will lower retail prices, citing factors out of Tesoro's control, including the crude oil market and retail competition. Weeks says Tesoro plans to open up use of Flint Hills' previously exclusive loading and distribution facilities to competing companies.
When we buy a terminal, we think the best use of the terminal is to optimize, fill it up. Our strategy is for all of our logistics assets to open them up to third parties? I will say we have not worked out how we're going to do that yet.
It's unclear who the other fuel suppliers might be. Tesoro runs a refinery in Kenai. Tesoro's purchase and lease of Flint Hills infrastructure does not include the shuttered North Pole refinery. A small hydropower project near Tanacross is one step closer to startup after receiving a $500,000 federal grant. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the project aims to use renewable energy to replace thousands of gallons a year of diesel fuel.
Alaska Power and Telephone is partnering with the village of Tanacross and the local Native Corporation to build a small hydropower project on Yurok Creek. Because the project lies on Native and state-owned lands, project manager Jason Custer says the company has sidestepped expensive and time-consuming federal permitting. Custer says the recent $500,000 federal grant will pay for powerhouse equipment. The company's received other federal and state grants, but more are needed, he says, if the project wants to reach the nearly $20 million cost.
We can't do the project just with private debt and equity alone. There's also a need for grants to help drive the cost of power down.
Custer explains the project needs to demonstrate it can supply power more economically than the current cost of diesel fuel that powers the communities today. Once the 1.5-megawatt project is up and running, he estimates it should cover 40% of the power needs of Tok, Tanacross, Tetlin, and Dot Lake for the next 50 to 100 years.
Right now, those communities are 100% dependent on diesel-based generation of electricity. So this would be the first time that they have access to renewable energy.
Custer says the region currently uses almost 400,000 gallons of diesel fuel a year. He hopes lawmakers see that any loan to the project will be offset by lower rural power subsidies. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
An old dam on the Iklutna River has blocked salmon runs there for decades. Now an Alaska Native Corporation and tribe wants to tear the dam down and restore fish to the river. The old Iklutna Dam was built in 1929 in a canyon 400 feet deep to divert Iklutna River water for Anchorage hydroelectric power. For half a century, the dam has been obsolete as far as power is concerned, but it is still blocking salmon runs.
There are five species of salmon that spawn in the lower reaches of the Iklutna, but they can't get past the dam.
Brad Micklejohn is the Alaska director for the Conservation Fund. The organization has pledged to pay the cost of the project, and the local Alaska Native Corporation, Iklutna Incorporated, is on board with the plan. Curtis McQueen, CEO of Iklutna Inc., says it's been a dream of his for years to see the dam removed. He says it will lift the spirits of the village, and that spirit is intertwined with salmon.
We have a few elders that are in their late 80s that as children remember where they would race out of their house, literally, to the Iklutna River, which was a raging river, and they were fed. So this all summer long, right into even late in the fall, they could count on their subsistence right in their backyard.
But over the decades, railroad and highway projects have altered the riverbed radically, essentially devastating the lower river near the village. A U.S. Army Corps of Engineers study done a couple of years ago confirmed the problem, but indicated mitigation is possible. McQueen says pools in the river bottom could be created for salmon fry to hide in, or riverbank restoration projects could provide protection for small fish.
Between the deep water and the protection, you might be able to improve the bottom, but that's not going to solve the big picture. And the big picture is someday getting more water down the watershed.
Since regular maintenance on the dam ceased decades ago, debris, boulders, and silt have built up behind it. That will have to be removed, but Brad Micklejohn says taking the old dam out will be easy compared to the task of getting more water back into the Iklutna River. The river is pretty much devoid of water these days because a second dam at Iklutna Lake diverts water to the hydropower station on the Knik River. That power plant was built under a federal program, then signed over to a consortium of Chugach Electric, Matanuska Electric Association, and Municipal Light and Power during the 1990s. The companies own the water rights to Eklutna Lake. Mickeljohn says a 1991 federal agreement requiring habitat mitigation could be a tool to pry at least some of that water loose. He recently told a Palmer audience.
And we're calling on all the parties that signed this agreement to open it up, start talking about mitigation. Our view is you break it, you fix it. You take all the water out of the river. It's a pretty clear impact. It's pretty easy to define.
Phil Steyer with Chugach Electric says his company is as yet unaware of the project and is not ready to comment yet. McQueen says Eklutna has a good relationship with all three companies and points out that MEA built its newest power facility on Eklutna land.
What we'd like to do at some point in the future is to have those conversations with the utilities and ask their help in finding a balance where they still have the hydro needs that they want, they still can generate the revenue off selling water. The question is, can some of that lake water be released or redirected back?
Mickeljohn says those conversations have yet to take place, and he says no one knows how much water is needed to restore salmon habitat. At this time, McQueen says Eklutna Inc. is focusing on removal of the old dam. Work is scheduled to begin next year, and it is hoped the village will be celebrating the dam's demise by 2018.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Jobs in rural Alaska are often seen as a career stepping stone. Professionals fill a job for a year or two and then leave, taking career skills and experience with them. How to break the cycle and retain workers is a puzzle for leaders in rural Alaska. As KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports, the community of Bethel thinks it's got one piece figured out.
The first thing I notice is the view, a fringe of willows and then miles of snowy tundra. I'm looking out the window of six new apartment buildings specifically constructed for public safety, education, and health professionals in Bethel. The idea is by providing high-quality, affordable housing, Bethel can better recruit and retain personnel. Bethel Community Services Foundation led the project. The group wants to address community issues, and Executive Director Michelle DeWitt says housing sits high on that list.
When people leave positions here, housing is often at the root of one of their challenges or one of their areas of dissatisfaction. You know, we have a lack of new, appropriate, nice housing.
These apartments are extremely nice. Wood pattern floors and cabinets, modern appliances, high energy conservation ratings, and of course, the scenic views. Mayor Rick Robb is also impressed.
Well, this is beautiful. There's no doubt. Of course, it's brand new, all redone, so it's beautiful. But this was kind of a white elephant, kind of an albatross, and it's been totally renovated.
The building was once a daycare center, left vacant several years ago. The push to revitalize an older building helped attract one of the project's funders, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. For over a decade, the corporation has funded housing projects for teachers, health professionals, and public safety workers across rural Alaska, all in an effort to decrease turnover. So far, the program has shown success with teacher retention. Derek Chan is a planner with the AHFC and says the key to keeping workers long-term is getting them to stay past the first year.
If a person works in an area beyond that one-year period, they're less likely to transition out. And that's what we're really trying to do. Is we're really just trying to provide an environment where they can call home. At the end of the day, they got a place to kick their feet up. They feel welcome.
Bethel City Manager Ann Capella says that initial welcome can make or break a new employee's first impression.
This is a true story. We had an employee come
take a job at Bethel. We had no place to put him up for the night. We put him up at the annex. He looked at his surrounding and he left on the first flight in the morning.
The city's newest hire, a firefighter EMT, will have a different experience. He arrived this week with his family and moved directly into one of the units. It's a step up from the fire department's usual protocol of housing new recruits in the fire station for their first month. Fire Chief Bill Howell hopes the apartments will attract more workers.
I would think that this is definitely helpful from a recruiting standpoint. You know, a lot of the time people have the financial resources to get housing in Bethel, and they just can't find it.
DeWitt with the Bethel Community Services Foundation says she'll consider the housing successful if people stay past 1 year.
I'd be really excited if we had people who were in the units for 18 months to 2 years, and I'd be even more excited if they left the units to purchase a home in our community. So retention is a really positive thing, and when you have quality people in important positions, the outcomes are better for everyone.
The units opened on Monday, and already 4 of the 6 spaces are occupied. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A new collection of essays about one of the most iconic figures in American literature has been published, shedding new light on his connections to Alaska. Ed Ricketts, From Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska, explores the relationship between the noted biologist of the title and John Steinbeck, the Nobel Prize-winning author who immortalized him. The book also deepens our understanding of Ricketts' 1932 trip to Sitka to collect marine specimens, with Sitka writer Jack Calvin and his wife, Sasha. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Ed Ricketts was the man behind the character Doc in John Steinbeck's 1945 novel, Cannery Row. But Ricketts was much more than a template of the hands-on biologist Steinbeck met in Monterey, California. Rather, Ricketts had a larger-than-life personality that translated well to the page. The two men cruised around the Baja Peninsula together on their most famous trip to collect marine specimens and co-authored The Log from the Sea of Cortez. Following Ricketts' death, Steinbeck updated the introduction to that book.
Knowing Ed Ricketts was instant. After the first moment I knew him, and for the next 18 years I knew him better than I knew anyone. And perhaps I didn't know him at all.
This is John Straley, one of the essayists who has contributed to the new book, Ed Ricketts, From Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska. His wife, Jan, a marine mammal biologist, edited the anthology. Another contributor is Nancy Ricketts, Ed's daughter. Nancy has lived in Sitka for over 40 years. She remembers quite well seeing her dad read Cannery Row shortly after it was published.
Some of the times his feet would come up off the floor and, oh. We'll just let it go that way. It was written in kindness.
In her essay, Nancy Ricketts tries to paint a more true-to-life portrait of her father than the hard-partying but dedicated commercial scientist who slept in his lab. She recalls family collecting trips in an old Packard with her father and mother and 2 siblings, roaming as far north as Puget Sound to collect different varieties of jellyfish for labs around the world. This was not your usual family business.
We wanted to go barefoot, but there were barnacles, and we had really tough feet certainly by the end of the summer. We could walk on barnacles easily, but for collecting, we wore tennis shoes, we wore bathing suits, and we wore a sweater over the bathing suit, and we would collect until the tide came up to the point where the gonionemas didn't come up anymore. They were hidden down below in the eelgrass. And that's when we stopped and went home. Dad preserved them outside, and Mother, I think, mostly was cooking, and we were all hungry.
In 1932, Ed Ricketts accompanied Sitkin Jack Calvin on a collecting cruise up the British Columbia and Alaska coast to Sitka. Also aboard Calvin's boat, the Grampus, were Calvin's wife, Sasha, and world literary scholar Joseph Campbell. That cruise would rewrite the study of intertidal marine biology. Jan Straley says that modern researchers have been trying to retrace the steps of Calvin and Ricketts.
A few years ago, the Sitka Sound Science Center received funding to do a comparative study between the 32 surveys and the current day surveys to see what changes had occurred over that time. And that paper was pivotal in us trying to figure out which species existed in 32.
John Straley, the writer, relied on his 3 decades of experience as an investigator to pull together the threads of the 1932 cruise aboard the Grampus.
There had been some snapshots taken of Ricketts and Calvin and some of the women that had been with them, you know, picnicking at those sites, and we went around to different places in Sitka Sound and, you know, studying the backdrops in those photographs, and we figured out that there were some near Pirate's Cove and some on Whale Island.
Shortly after the cruise, Calvin and Ricketts published Between Pacific Tides. The text wasn't just a detailed reference book, it turned biology on its head. Instead of identifying and grouping intertidal creatures by their common characteristics or taxonomy, Calvin and Ricketts organized animals by their habitat in the intertidal zone. John Straley says the breakthrough occurred in the literary conversations the group had at night over the course of the 10-week cruise.
And Sasha really had been one of the key people to crack this poem by Robertson Jeffers called The Roan Stallion, and where they really figured out that focusing on taxonomy of the creatures and focusing on the human intellect was not the key to understanding the interconnectedness of all this life that they were immersing themselves in the tide pool. And this would affect Campbell's work in cross-cultural storytelling and myth-making, and also with Ricketts in this deeper understanding of ecology.
Between Pacific Tides, to this day, remains a core textbook of intertidal biology. Joseph Campbell's ideas would influence Western literary thinking for years. One young filmmaker, George Lucas, based his innovative Star Wars trilogy on principles Campbell outlines in his book, The Power of Myth. So, whether you're flying the Millennium Falcon in the theater this holiday season, or cruising up the coast of Southeast Alaska in the Grampus, know that Ed Ricketts, the Calvins, and Joseph Campbell all shaped your universe. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ann Hillman, Josh Edge, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.